Accession number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 12.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 12. What other types of patrols, inquiry, Colonel, either that you were involved with yourself or those that you knew about?
Well, when we were in Korea, of course, because it was a sort of 1914-18 type campaign by the time we got there, patrolling was the main function at the time. And the aim of all the patrolling was, in very broad terms, to get information about the enemy. The enemy, I mean, we knew basically that they were the Chinese army. Now I'm trying to think what they were called. The People's Liberation Army, sorry, People's Liberation Army. They were actually in front of us. And it was to find out as much information as possible about them. And everything would start off with a recce patrol. And then the other two types of patrol basically were an ambush patrol or a fighting patrol. An ambush patrol would be set up at an obvious, or maybe not so obvious, but at a place where you could fairly safely assume that at some time or another the enemy would come through. An obvious place are minefield gaps, because if he wanted to penetrate into our position, unless he was going to walk through a minefield, which he obviously didn't want to do, he would have to use a minefield gap, and they were fairly obvious because they were marked for a benefit. And so an obvious place for an ambush would be normally on the enemy side of a minefield gap. There were or could be other places where you would mount an ambush, but they were very few and far between, because, as I say, you had to be fairly certain that the enemy were going to use that track or path or whatever it may have been. An ambush patrol would go out for the hours of darkness, and all the preparation and briefing follow the same pattern as for all the patrols were the same. They would follow the same pattern, as I say, for briefing, rehearsal, previous day or the previous 2 days, or, you know, depended how involved the operation was going to be. And an ambush patrol could be a platoon, could be a complete platoon, three sections, staying in its normal sort of command. In other words, platoon headquarters and three sections, commanded by the platoon commander with the three section commanders, and going out, as I say, at last light and coming back at first light. That was a fairly long time. It was at bars. And that was okay when the weather was sort of summer or autumn or spring, but winter, you couldn't stay out for that length of time. And so any ambush patrols during the winter were a far shorter duration, obviously on the weather, but could be 3 or 4 hours at the very most. And so, in fact, ambush patrols during the winter were probably of doubtful value, because by the time you got out there and sorted yourselves out, it's almost time to come back in again, because it really, you couldn't lie around in ambush in that weather.
It must have been a heavy stress on nerves lying out in a no-man-land situation.
Yes. Obviously, I suppose the whole thing is a bit of a stress and strain, but it was what we trained to do, and quite honestly, at that age then, one didn't think about it. It was a job, and yes, you were frightened. As I think I've said before, one of the main problems was the noises, identifying noises. And of course, lying out there, there were also animals, rats, vermin, all sorts of funny things moving around. And that all makes you a little bit jumpy. But in fact, I saw three ambush patrols in the period of time I was a rifle platoon commander. And we didn't have any sort of alarms or excursions. The soldiers were really very good. It would have been very easy for someone to think he'd seen something or heard something and blast off into the undergrowth. But in fact, they didn't. Didn't have any contact at all on the three patrols. That, of course, is part of the frustration. You get all keyed up, and then you're lying out there. It might be raining, it might be wet, certainly getting cold or cold. Nothing happens. I think one of the main problems, certainly I personally found, was staying awake. Particularly if nothing was going on. I mean, it was dead quiet. It was difficult to keep awake because you couldn't get up and move around. You were just lying there.
So you had to rely on the other men in their positions staying awake because you couldn't...
Well, we had a buddy-buddy system, we'd look after one another just to make sure we all were more or less awake. And if it was all night, which is a very long time, in fact, you can't expect people to stay completely alert all that time. We would knock it down perhaps to half a section, staying fully alert. So as long as they didn't start snoring, you're all right. And you could get away with that. My platoon sergeant and I would take it in turns. One of the major problems, funnily enough, thinking about it as we were talking, we would take out communications were called the 88 set. It was a wireless station 88, I think, but it was an infantry manpack station. But certainly it was fairly early on, and obviously, and it fitted into two pouches, like ammunition pouches, with a battery on one side and the radio on the other. And although it was limited, it was communications. It was nice to know that you could talk if necessary, because of course, again, particularly with ambush, but with any type of patrol, we were very well off with regard to calling for defensive fire, DF fire, from machine guns or artillery or mortars. It was always very good and very quick if we needed it. But of course, this radio made a noise, sort of hissing noise, when it was switched on. And without wishing to be unkind, knowing there were company commanders and so on who were sitting in their command posts in the company position, who would ask for sit reps. That would echo around the whole of South Korea in the night, and so I'm afraid we used to pull the switch, we used to switch it off. Once we'd established that the thing was working and we could talk if necessary, we used to switch it off. A, it had this squelch sound, and B, as I say, occasionally you would get people saying, "Send sit rep over." Oh, gosh, shut up. So But we had communications, and people did use them to get help if necessary. And so that was very good. So that's an ambush patrol.
The sleeping element that you were mentioning, was that a kind of a standard practice, or did it just grow?
Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly that's what I did after the first one, because I realised that a fair number of them were asleep. I mean, okay, there was not a lot I could do about it. Stamping around the place and kicking people, which of course wasn't the object of the exercise at all. I knew you'd pass the word around and you'd wake them up. And so this is how we sort of built up this buddy system, where we would try to make sure we were all awake at any given time. But, as I say, during a 12-hour stint, depending obviously on the conditions, depending on noise, if there was a lot of sort of artillery banging around, not near us but around sufficiently to make it difficult to hear anything, then you would stay awake. Or if there was any light, moon or artificial light, because there were quite a number of places where they used searchlight, artificial light that had been developed at the end of the Second World War. And that did produce quite a good light. And it was one of the things you could ask for in a crisis. If you want, you could ask for searchlight. And so it depended on the circumstances. But certainly I did it, and I know a number of people did it. Otherwise, you could all have been asleep without too much difficulty, bearing in mind you've been up and about all the day before. I think wherever young people are, whatever they are, they have an ability. You know.
It didn't happen in your case, but had you made a contact, you were using your usual weapons against them, would that not alert the Chinese to attempt to hit you with mortar or what have you?
Well, yes, except, of course, that the only time we would fire was if we had something to fire at. And so then we'd be talking of ranges about 20 to 30 metres. So it'd all be very, at least, at the most. The ideal is to get the enemy into your killing zone, which is in between your sections. And so you'd all be very close. They would know that we were firing, or presumably they would know that if we were firing down there, they would know whether they had people in that area or not. And so, no, it wouldn't really have helped anyone to call for fire at that stage. But of course, later on, yes, as either we withdrew or they withdrew, or we both withdrew. Then you would have a series of tasks plotted to chase them back and try to catch them in the open on the way back. And, yeah, they would do the same with us. Theirs would mainly be mortar. Ours would probably be 25-pounder.
Were they particularly active, the Chinese, in a patrolling sense?
It varied considerably. I saw two parties when I was on recce patrols. But yeah, we've every reason, and other patrols, other platoons, other people out on patrol, yeah, they saw them, they were moving around. We were slightly puzzled sometimes as to what they were trying to do, because they were just walking, you know, moving around in the valley, in the paddy fields. But obviously they knew what they were doing, they were going from A to B. Yes, they were out and about. I don't think to the same extent as us, because the Commonwealth Division prided itself on its patrolling. I think we really were probably the only organisation that did it to any extent, and with great success, because it meant, certainly while we were there, that we knew pretty well what was going on in the valley floor and on the other side, and even the Black Watch battle on the Hook, they got not early warning, but, you know, they knew that something was going on, and because they had standing patrols out. Standing patrols, sorry, I should have mentioned, each forward position had standing patrols out, and they were normally a corporal, lance corporal, and two, with either a telephone or an 88 set, depending on what was available usually. And they would be out anything 500 metres, in depending on the situation, could be anything up to about 500 metres in front of our positions. And a platoon would probably find one of these, a forward platoon, would probably find one. And again, it would be in front of our defensive wire. And their job would be to give early warning, not to take on the enemy by any manner of means. And they'd be, obviously, again, fairly near, or actually on, a minefield gap. And that system, which presumably had been developed in the First and the Second World Wars, although I'm not aware of it, did they have standing patrols in the First World War? I've no idea. Anyway, certainly we did it. And I think the Commonwealth Division was the only people who did that. And it did mean that we were not very often caught by surprise. The other sort of patrol, fighting patrol, again, probably a platoon size, and the object of that patrol almost every time would be to capture a prisoner. And so that would involve a recce patrol going out to find a route and a likely place on the enemy position to take a prisoner. And of course to bring him back. Nine times out of ten that was the object of that sort of fighting patrol. one of the problems was that the Chinese defensive positions essentially were very deep, could be 10 feet or more deep trench, round the top of a hill, round the crown of a hill, with facing out towards us, towards the enemy. They would probably tunnel from that trench through the hill and then just have a little sort of gun port as opposed to a bunker or a slit trench. And so you had this very deep trench, and I won fighting patrol. The officer decided, presumably round this trench on the top of the Chinese position, they would have telephone lines. And so he worked out a plan, and if they went up there and he had his fighting patrol, they would set up a firm base, probably at the bottom of the hill, and he and half a dozen hand-picked people would go up as an assault group. And the idea was to cut the telephone wire, and inevitably that would attract a line party to come and mend it. And when the line party came, they would snatch them and take them away. And everything went according to plan. In fact, it was just one little Chinaman, or he wasn't particularly little actually, he was a fairly big Chinaman. Of course, that was one thing that disliked people. Everyone seemed to think Chinamen being small, but there were one or two monsters, or not monsters, but they were very big Chinamen. And this one man came along with his insulating tape and his pliers to mend the line, and they bopped him all right. they couldn't get him out of this great big trench, because Geordie is not the biggest of soldiers. And they were heaving and pushing and pulling. eventually they did get him out, but it was a major drama. And then they had to move fairly quickly, obviously. And I mean, he was unconscious. They'd bashed him on the head. Unfortunately, again, they'd bashed him so hard that he didn't survive the journey. There was a fighting patrol, from his kit and so on. They were able to do a bit of identification. The only other sort of major activity would be a raid, which I would classify really as being a company strength. And there were, I think, two or three carried out by the battalion during the time we were there. And again, this really was just to not necessarily capture prisoners. It was to maintain an aggressive stance. And if they had a position that looked a bit isolated or vulnerable, a company would attack it or raid it. These, the three the battalion did, they were okay, but there was no great, it wasn't a great battle. In fact, sadly, the casualties, I think, possibly outweighed the value, I don't know. But certainly, to my knowledge, two company commanders were lost. And these were people who'd gone all the way through the Second World War.
Do you recall the names?
Pat Donoghue was one, who, before the Second World War, had been a corporal in a battalion in China, and had been commissioned during the war, got an MC, and was a great guy. And Johnny Tresorno, who had come to us from the DCLI before we went to Korea and brought a company with him, he was another one. They were both killed as a result of taking part in raids or you know. I mean, that is that sort of war, and one must accept it.
You didn't personally take part?
I didn't take part in any of those.
Do you know whether they were looked on with dread by those that had to take the balance, they may lose more than they gain?
No, but of course, being in a different company, in a different area, you didn't know it was happening. They sort of publicised it, saying D Company's going on a raid tonight, and so you didn't know anything about it. Until either, literally, they may have been coming through your position. In fact, they didn't ever come through me, but they obviously had to go through someone's position. So obviously that lot would know. But I don't think in those days anyone questioned that sort of thing. I think you were just given orders to do something, and away you went and did it. Whether the people, the company commanders, who, as I say, had been through the Second World War, wondered at all what they were on, whether they thought they'd done their whack, and you know, it was a bit daft chasing around South Korea, chasing Chinamen. I don't know. They may have done, but they never talked about it. There was no discussion about it. It was just another operation of war, the same as if the fighting had been more fluid, we'd have been platoon attacks and company attacks and up that hill and down that hill and all the rest of it.
The enemy positions, you obviously were on a hillside. Then you talked about the valley. What was the terrain like?
Well, it was hills, you see, and each hill feature was separated from its neighbour by a valley of differing width. Some were very skinny, others were quite wide. And that was where the cultivation had taken place. That's where the villages had been. Obviously, in the front line, there was no sign of any habitation. All the villages had gone. And, of course, the paddy fields, the rice fields, were still there. And the rice, the paddy buns, that's the little walls, retaining walls, around all the fields, they were still there. and at the appropriate season, the fields are either dry or flooded or frozen or whatever. And that was known as the valley floor. And if you went from one hill to another, obviously you had to go down and up. And the distances between ourselves and the Chinese varied considerably from, I suppose, in a straight line, not going down, 400 yards to a couple of miles in one position, where the valley had really opened out into a plain almost, everything in between in distances. Sometimes you're very close, other times you're quite a long way away.
Were there any particular weapons which the Chinese had which gave you trouble, gave you problems, particularly from the point of view, say, of shelter and dealing with them?
Well, yes, they were very good with mortars, and they had, and they used those very well, from 60 millimeter mortars up to 120. And really, we didn't have much else. Very occasionally we'd have shell fire, but it was normally mortars. And they were very good. They were very quick with their mortars. And of course, the problem in a hilly situation like that is you could normally register the 120 millimetre and the 80 millimetre, or the 60 millimetre, which is roughly the equivalent of British 2-inch mortar. Really, it was so quick. You by the time you realised it was there. You know, you didn't get much warning of the 60 millimetre. And they were just as dangerous as the big ones. They'd kill you just the same as the big ones. But they were the main problem. The Chinese personal weapon, of course, was the I don't know what its official name was. It was called the burp gun. It was a drum-fed submachine gun with a very high rate of fire, which is why it was called a burp gun. Presumably developed from a Russian weapon of World War II vintage, I suspect. But that was the noise you would hear in out on patrol or during the night. You'd hear bursts of burp gun. You know someone was doing something somewhere. So it was mortars. It was mortars that I remember. You see, I don't remember any machine gun fire of any of the Chinese at all. It may well have been. Probably was, but I can't remember it. It doesn't stick in my mind. The mortars do.
What was the usual retaliation if you did spot the mortar and you were able to position?
You'd report it because if it was during the day, most people in the front forward positions were on the night shift. You'd be up all night working because you were in view of the enemy, or could have been. And so you were up all night working and sleeping during the day. Well, during the day you would have sentries on, two or three, one per section probably, in a platoon. If they heard a mortar, they would try to give a mort rep, as it was called, mortar report. But quite honestly, there's no point in trying to, unless it was being a nuisance, there's no point in trying to hit every individual mortar that you heard, because, of course, that is the whole point of a mortar. You can pick it up and shift it very quickly, and I'm sure they did. So you'd report them, but, as I say, unless they were being a nuisance, you wouldn't expect necessarily any reaction. My position, we had about 200 rounds of mortar, in, I don't know, an hour. And we thought that was preliminary to an attack for various reasons. In fact, it wasn't, didn't turn out that way. But and obviously, we were not in a position to report where all those were coming from. Other people were doing that. And yes, they were having a go at those.
What is the result of being under that kind of intense fire? How will the men react to it?
Well, in fact, again, they were really very good. Because we were all fairly well underground. And although I'm in that situation, everyone went into their bunkers except the two sentries per section in this particular case, who stayed in the forward trenches. But you see, they had, each trench had a what we call a funk hole at each end of the slit trench, a fairly deep